and welcome to Lunch with Leon, and I'm your host, Leon Daniels. Every episode, I hope to bring you a chair at a nice lunch with me and one of my friends from around the world. Lunch with Leon is brought to you by our sponsors, Total Care, the experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Total Care has been supporting the passenger and commercial transport industry for decades. In fact, this year, they're celebrating the 40th anniversary of supplying their popular mobile column lifts in the UK. We're delighted to have them sponsoring our lunch. So for those of you who listened to the previous episode, Steve Norris is a very hard act to follow. So I'm really glad that my guest this week is James Hallock, who's the Managing Director, Highways and Waste Collections at AMI PLC. James has 25 years experience of highways, communications and tunnel engineering projects here and overseas. So we caught up.
James, to start with, we see each other nearly every other week on the Highway Sector Council.
We do indeed, Leon, we do.
What's going on with Highway Sector Council right now?
I actually think we're in a really exciting point now where there's been that sort of forming, storming stage where a whole bunch of, I suppose, disparate individuals with absolute heart for the highway sector, you know, passionately believe in the sector, who've, I suppose, being unhappy, uncomfortable that while we've all tried to do our own thing, that recognition that collaboratively, if we came together with really going for some big, hairy arse objectives, we could make a difference. But recognising it needed all of us, whether it be from the private sector, through like a debt to local authorities, through to the strategic roads, such as Highways England, as well as the consultant and contractors, if we actually came together and tackled some of those big, meaty problems, went to the Department of Transport as one, actually, we got a fighting chance. We can make a fist of making a difference that we've longed for some years. So when I say it's an exciting point, I think we've done that forming, storming. We've tried to coalesce around a number of areas, around a lot of agendas, no surprises, people, safety, environment, but then tried to break it down to what can we deliver? What's the big ambition that we can deliver, which we think is doable, but needs, if you like, the DFT to come on that journey as well. So we're at the stage, this milestone, where we're having that discussion with the department and we look forward to actually, I think, getting a green light in a few areas, which we then can widen across the wider highway sector to bring in other partners, friends, interest groups, but have them all focused on that outcome, that line of sight to where we want to go.
Because Rail has done a good job on this, isn't it? There's a rail sector deal, which has, again, brought together similar sorts of people and is doing very well. This is not some sort of cartel or any sort of private group. There are just some areas where we are much stronger together than we are separately. And we'll still bid aggressively. We'll still try and get competitive advantage and all the rest of it. But in some of those areas, skills, innovation, technology, all of those things, we are just stronger together, aren't we?
Oh, aren't we just? And, you know, really emphasise that point, this is anything but a chummy club. We're very blessed with having Anna DeVecchio, as we know, our colleague who actually was one of the sort of leaders, drivers for the rail sector deal. And she's keeping us very much on that straight and narrow on what actually we need to achieve, so we're not getting, if you like, blown by the wind to go down blind alleys. So project management-wise and objective-wise, that's very clear. And I think then coming back to your point around the focus on making sure this is for the whole sector, that's why I think this is unique with the private public sector plus strategic road authorities plus the DFT all in this tent together.
Anna, of course, is the powerhouse in the Highway Sector Council. She talked me into it by saying it would be a couple of hours four times a year. So I thought, well, that's okay. We can, that'll be easy to do. That turned out to be quite different because it was interesting, wasn't it? We barely got ourselves started and organized. Then the virus arrived and we found ourselves on a special mission for the department, where for the Department for Transport, where they needed our help to try and keep highway projects going during the lockdown. We had some crazy situations, didn't we, where the police were trying to stop people from doing works on the highway.
Yeah, and, you know, I think all of us at heart, you know, safety is our number one priority, and what a golden opportunity. And, you know, so I use that word awfully cautiously, that everybody's stuck at home, we've got a global pandemic, and yet we're trying to take advantage of the fact there's very little traffic on the road, far safer, far more effective and productive to be doing the work. And yes, you know, different views were taken, say in Scotland, where construction all but ceased, through to Highways England, who are positively encouraging us to try and maximise what we could at the time. I think what we did well as a sector is come together and try and write some standard safety guidelines. And again, not doing it in isolation, working with the wider constructions sector to make sure there was alignment, we're not causing confusion or ambiguity. But boy, did we move quickly. And I think as we sit here today, Leon, we've got to be quite proud of that. And I think there's nothing like a few quick wins showing actually that power of coming together can make a difference. And yeah, I think that was a good foundation to where we've got to now.
It's interesting, isn't it, how things turn out. So, of course, the pandemic is a terrible crisis, but we were in the process of forming ourselves. We got together, we produced some good material, and the department was able to go out and talk to some of the local authorities, the highway authorities, and say, look, here's how you can do it. Keep going. And one of the reasons why I'm keen that we keep going with the Highway Sector Council right now is that it's part of the UK's economic recovery. Getting
jobs
back to work, getting people back in action, it's part of the UK's recovery. And I think that the work the Highway Sector Council is doing is fabulous.
Yeah, so you know, just a final sort of reflection just on the Sector Council and that importance, as you sort of alluded to, actually as part of the bounce back. You know, if we look at reports that McKinsey and others have done after the financial crisis in 2008, what that showed was actually the construction sector was absolutely agile in bringing different people into the sector. It actually accelerated innovation and was a very useful tool to get government spend quickly to the community, but at the same time, actually make a difference in doing it as well. So social mobility increased significantly, innovation, and actually SMEs were getting a pound in their pocket far quicker. So actually that bounce back is more critical today than it's ever been.
No, that's entirely right. That's why we're so active now with the Highway Sector Council, isn't it? Because this, the benefit to everybody, the UK economy, let's face it, if everybody's not back to work, there won't be any money to pay for the NHS. So the sooner the economic recovery is underway, the better. And I know we're part of it.
Connecting the country, that's what we do.
That's what we do, yeah. The other reason I was talked into it is because, like you, I'm passionate about safety. And we've really done some good work, not just in the context of the coronavirus, but actually generally about safety. And if I think back to the early part of my career, it's amazing that we didn't have much more accidents, because we've now become absolutely passionate about safety across, not just on highways, but in construction, on construction sites, on railway. Things are so different.
Yeah. You know, if I look back, you know, my career, I've had the position where I've had to sit in front of a widow, a partner of a deceased operative six times. Not only imprints itself into your memory, it burns, it sears yourself into the memory. And you're left with always, what can we do different? What can we do better? Ultimately, it's not like the rail network, which is a closed network. The highways network is open. It's open to anybody to drive upon it. And if I go through, you know, the very serious instance we've had over the years, it's generally an errant driver, something you can't legislate for. So I think the huge step forward we've taken is a principle of removing people from the danger area. Within my business, I'm very focused on what I've called Vision 2030, is by 2030, we'll have nobody working on or alongside the road network. What's driving that is absolutely the presenting issue is safety. But actually below that, Leon, it's if we can do things a different way, use technology, automation, we're going to be programming far better. So productivity increases, which has been, I would say, a real Achilles heel of the construction sector for the last 30 years is productivity has been almost flatlined. But moreover, because we do the job differently, and we're already using drones far more, we're having people sitting in offices doing the surveys instead of being out on site, it means we can have a different type of road worker who isn't dragging cones and signs. There's people doing it in between the school run. In this age we're now in on the technology, so it greatly improves the diversity of our sector, the other Achilles heel. You know, you and I are men of a certain age, yet if we look across my contracts, 55 would be an average age. You know, we do need to move, accelerate far quicker to bring that diversity into the sector. And the way to do it is make it a far more enjoyable place to work, a fun place to work, And by doing that, we carry on that safety journey, which has been transformative. We've created a paradigm shift in safety, but we need to do a lot more still.
We do. I don't know about you, right at the earliest days of safety initiatives, it was about processes and notices and things that were widely ignored. It really changed when we got people to think it. And as soon as it was hardwired into their brains, people then started to think safety. I don't know about you, but if I travel overseas to countries perhaps that are not so advanced as we are, it sends an alarm bell off in your head, doesn't it? You see unsafe practices happening. And this bell goes off in your head. So, my God, look how they're doing, working at heights, not properly secured, no PPE, open sites and so on. So in our case, and for a lot of our colleagues, it's now hardwired in their heads, isn't it? And you can't work unsafely because your brain just won't let you now.
That is spot on. We've always got to guard against complacency. And if you'll give an example to really illustrate your point, back in 2010, a road worker was crossing the M4 and was struck by a vehicle. Then the following day, the Highways England Control Centre brought a video of this chap who had been working the day before he was killed. And he actually showed him getting out of his vehicle and effectively jumping between the cars to get to the Central Reserve to change a sign. Fully trained, highly competent, been on that site, but complacency. So while on safe acts, I think if you're not, if we go into the motorway today, Leon, alarm bells would be ringing. That the sense of the cars passing us, the draft, the back draft, the noise. You do that day in, day out, you get complacent. And I think what that fatality showed me and a lot of my colleagues, and I played quite a big part in helping change the legislation that we no longer had to have people crossing the carriageway, because it was actually a requirement by standards. That always being aware of, is there stuff we are accepting today, because it's always been the way it's done, even though that alarm bell you're talking about saying, this isn't good. And what I continually say to graduates, people coming into the sort of business, is do not accept just because that's the way it's always been done is correct. If it looks wrong, it probably is wrong. And we can change standards, even the law, to stop it where we get the right evidence. Let's not wait for a fatality.
Sure. So in First Group, our first big safety initiative was managed by DuPont, who came
went
through the organisation. And we all thought, as always, this was just another initiative. But it caught everybody at a different moment. But you did start to climb the stairs and hold the handrail and have sufficient points of contact. And you did start to be effectively doing mini risk assessments throughout your entire working day, even if it's just about the area around your desk or the corridor or whatever. And I knew we'd cracked it because in First Group, our offices were those offices on platform one at Paddington Station, where, of course, Great Western Trains is part of First Group. And I saw something that really made me happy. A junior lady accounts person, and she came out of the office door onto platform one at Paddington Station, and she saw a Great Western train driver jump out of the cab down onto the platform. Now, he's a 20-year, 30-year serving big man, She's a junior accounts person. She marched across the platform to him and said, excuse me, I work for First Group. Would you just mind explaining to me how you think that's safe? Now, when you've got a junior person challenging a big train driver, now you know you've got it, because now you know it's in their minds. And that's made me feel great.
That's a perfect example, isn't it? And it's one to be championed. I suppose what I always liked with the DuPont stuff was the way they then carried it through into people's private lives.
Yes.
Looking at your behaviours at home. Because actually, if you are going to hardwire people to think differently, it has to be at home and in the workplace.
Completely. And Sir Moy Lockhead, the chief executive, said he knew he'd cracked it. It was when his wife reverse parked her car at home.
Yes. Yeah. Do you know, but that's lovely. At home, I remember the state we used to live in and started parking, reverse parking. And I was the only person. Over time, the whole street reverse parks.
Yes. It's infectious. It is infectious. The thing I'm always happy about, there are thousands of people, our employees, that are alive today who wouldn't have been alive if we hadn't done all this. Now, of course, we don't know who they are because the accident never happened. The line I always used to take with staff was there are just tens of thousands of our employees who are alive today and wouldn't have been if the proper protective measures that we all put in place and changed our behaviours, changed our processes. And that's got to be good because, as you said earlier, going to see the widow of an employee and trying to explain how somebody who was perfectly entitled to come home safely from work every day just wasn't going to be coming home anymore. And it's a heartrending experience. And it's just critical that we never do that again. So I'm with you totally on it. And we've made fabulous progress. And I think as far as the whole highway sector is concerned, it's quite rightly a top priority. It starts at the top. And the way the chief executive behaves cascades downwards. So he or she has to behave in the same way he'd expect he or she would.
I think within the highway sector, what's, I think, particularly strong, and I've seen that in my time, is the way safety moved from being an afterthought to being seen as something you should say, to being competitive, to now being absolutely at the core, the number one imperative. And it's frankly uncompetitive. It is very much we're all in this together.
We don't want a direct financial comparison, but actually good safety is good business, isn't it? As anybody who's ever been sued, taken to court as a result of lapses, it is good business. It's good business in terms of your credentials in bidding for work. And it's also cheaper because you never end up with the costs associated with a terrible accident or fatality, never mind the moral implications.
And I always think it's really quite interesting. When you look at, No Wind, No Fee lawyers, what have you, they have actually made Britain, I think, one of the safest countries. Well, it is, if you look at HSE data, because what it does, you know, you've got to tick every box. You've got to do everything right. You've got to do the behavioural program. You've got to do it all. There is no one thing. And these people keep us honest about not falling back and forgetting what's important.
Sure. Now, the other reason why you and I talk about this a lot, I'm really passionate about the diversity and inclusion agenda, because to be fair, the highway sector, in common with a number of others, has been dominated by white men for a long time, old white men in many cases, like me. The diversity and inclusion is so rewarding. So thinking back to when I was forced to close the Hammersmith flyover in December 2011 because of its potential impending collapse, it was fabulous to be able to get young women graduates, people from other ethnic backgrounds inside the structure. This is something they were never going to see in their careers again. It's the only post-tension steel concrete flyover in existence in the UK and possibly wider than that. So to have them inside learning was just amazing. And as soon as we knew that it was safe to go inside and start to do some work, and I think we've made a lot of progress there too, haven't we?
Oh, very much so. It does start with inputs. I think you described it well there, that there's no point saying to people, come and work in this sector, it's really exciting, you've got a great career, if actually you turn up to the location and it's not a nice place to be. So I felt very strongly throughout that we have to get each of the stages right, the inputs, the working environment, the depot, proper facilities for disabled, as well as prayer rooms or at least quiet rooms for different, obviously, ethnic mixes. And then you then talk about, well, actually, what's a career? And how do you then balance, actually, instead of having people working 12-hour shifts, how do you balance it against in between school runs? And you've just got to tick each of those items off one by one. And I think that's where we see some companies doing it better than others. There's also attracting people into the sector. Within my business, it's the same in every other business. We do an awful lot of STEM work and we're actually doing a lot more joined up now. You know, my lovely little example is a business, Amy Business. We worked with the Girl Guides Association to create an engineering badge. That was about 2 years ago. And we put aside money for about 15,000 or so badges. 125,000 later. From, you know, really enthusiastic young ladies, girls who are interested in engineering. And that's proved that, like, a connection. It's proved a way which we can actually join up with other organisations like ourselves to try and get more people in. We run an annual competition, which I particularly like, which we call the Amy Challenge Cup. We specifically go to schools from deprived areas, from ethnic if you like, areas in the country, in Birmingham, Coventry and the like. And we actually have a full day engineering problem, but not your typical build a bridge. This is actually getting them in, tackle a problem, having engineers providing consultancy advice, if you like, to them. We then get clients in to give a client perspective. Oh, and 3/4 of the way through the day, we say, by the way, money's tight, you've cut your budget by 10%. And really try and create a real sort of what our job is about, Leon, It isn't there's a nice straw bridge, go away and build it. It doesn't work that way. So it's trying to actually prove a degree of honesty about what it's like. I think that honesty comes across as authentic, and that authentic makes people curious. This could be a good role career for them.
Yeah, I am really glad that there doesn't seem to be now the obstacle there was for people from different ethnic backgrounds or different gender to get into the industry. In fact, if anything, we're warmly welcoming these people into the industry, aren't they?
I always come back to, you know, I'm managing highway networks, whether it be Northern Ireland, Scotland, you know, down south, all over the place. We represent those communities, and those communities are all different. There isn't a one-size-fits-all. The other area I'm particularly passionate around is social mobility and a diversity of different people, giving people opportunities to move up effectively through a different social ladder and opportunities of health, well-being to them and their families that provides. So I think I look at it in a wider sense. In particular, I've spent a fair amount trying to get more ex-offenders into our business. So I spent time looking at Timpsons, and I visited Timpsons where they have about 10% ex-offenders, met with James and even Sir John Timpson, actually. The approach they've taken, and then what we've done in our business is we use an organisation called Recycling Lives. And part of my business is actually covers waste collections, the household waste. We have about 5,000 TVs a month, believe it or not, we get from our household waste sites. Goes through Recycling Lives. They have 12 prison academies, where effectively they create workshops to strip these old TVs off the precious components. Do a full day shift, this is training. They get paid about 40% plus more than the minimum prison wage. That's put aside. Out of all that, when they leave prison, help them with jobs, that money it's saved has been put in a bank account, helps them with their initial housing. Success rate, a 4% reoffending compared to about 66% in the normal prison population. And that's about 75% of those individuals are still in a permanent job compared to 17% 1 year later. Cost of keeping somebody in prison, 40,000 a year, and there's 84,000 prisoners.
Wow. So that's extraordinary, isn't it?
And I do. This is where I think us within our sector, and coming back to, I mentioned McKinsey, with the work they did about how the highway sector or construction sector can be a tool to bounce back, I think it includes that as well. It's not just diversity. It's actually thinking about how we can have greater social value, social impact, through whether it be ex-offenders, people from the military and the like.
Do you know, that's really interesting. You've reminded me. So when I was in TfL, I took my management team. We had a management away day inside Belmarsh Prison Young Offenders. Mm-hmm. Firstly, that was an interesting experience for the team because it's not the sort of thing you normally see, the inside of a prison. But we did it for another reason, which is that one of the qualifications you can get in the Young Offenders part of Belmarsh is a catering qualification. Because they're doing cooking and serving and so on. But of course, in order to get the qualification that's recognised in the outside world, you can't just serve each other. You have to serve the public. Well, it's very difficult to serve the public if you're in prison. So by taking my management team there, they prepared us lunch and we had our lunch. They cooked it and served it and cleared it away. We counted as the public. So they got their catering qualifications as a result of us being there, as a result of which, when they left prison, they had a qualification that got them into work, which they otherwise wouldn't have had. There are even indirect things that teams can do to help with offenders, especially.
And that's been extended, actually, because there's a social organisation which trades under the name of The Clink, and it's a restaurant. And they've got one in London, one in Manchester, and I've been to the one in Manchester, where it's exactly, they've, effectively, you're in the grounds of the prison, but they've set up a proper restaurant. And you actually go in there, you have a superb meal. The one thing, of course, no alcohol, but we all can survive one night without a drink, I'm sure. And so they've taken what you've done there and taken it to the next level and actually commercialised it. And that's what it's about. You know, nobody's looking for charity here. We're trying to make a difference, but doing it the right way.
The thing that sort of shines through in all these things that we've been talking about, this is how collaboration works. And just to be clear, this is not anti-competitive. This is collaboration. We are stronger together. We talked about it in the Highway Sector Council. But isn't it refreshing when you are working with people in other businesses, other walks of life, where the default answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Now, too often the default answer is no, unless you persuade me otherwise. But it's great when you find people. One of the things we learned, in fact, during the Olympics, you needed a team of people whose default answer to you was yes. Yes, if I can. Out of that, you get great collaboration. We only got through the Olympics because we had a team of people from all of the agencies, from across the sectors. We had people whose default answer was yes, if I can. So if you needed something or you needed something doing, it could be done. And one of our greatest Olympic legacies is that companies learned to have a default answer of yes. Yeah. And we all ended up with an address book of people who you could rely on, come and help. And I think that collaboration, which just, it helps the country make progress because we can all make progress. And I used to say, indeed, in civil contracts that you might have been involved in, at the great contract signing ceremony, my view always was, if we ever saw these contracts again, we would have failed because yes. The contracts out of the vault means that there must be some sort of problem and you're looking in the small print to find out what the mechanism for resolving it is and whose fault it is. Do you know, by the time you got to that point, you've failed. The best thing you can do with a contract is put it in the vault and forget it and work on a collaborative basis because shit happens on both sides, both on the client side and on the supplier side. What you want is somebody who'll hold your hand through the difficulties and celebrate the outcome. I very rarely find the answer to that on page 400 of the contract.
No, and I remember working for a senior officer from the Highways Agency a long time ago, and the way he described it, so taking your point, and he spun it slightly different and said, it's great here, we've got a good job to deliver, but we're going to deliver it come what may. The choice is ours now. Do we go down one route, which is going to be fighting, getting the clauses out, and gosh, you're under an old IC5, I knew every clause. We spent 2 years building the job and 4 years arguing in court afterwards. So we'd deliver it either that way, or we'd deliver it in a collaborative way, we'd have some fun, and we'd be proud of what we achieved. And he always then looked you in the eye and said, the decision's entirely yours.
That's beautiful.
It always rang true with me. We have options, we have choices.
Yeah.
And what I think the Olympics did, I think, and you know, I don't think I've told you the story. So I took over management of the Area 3 network in 2008, which is all the south of England. And I used the Olympics as a massive theme. We branded everything for the Olympics because we gave everybody a target, a vision. In 4 years, we had to play our part in making sure the trunk road network, the motorway network, was flowing beautifully for the Olympics. And I think for the Olympics, that gave everybody that understanding. If you set a vision, a common goal, regardless who you work for, if you're all set on that as your outcome you're trying to achieve, life is so much easier.
Without a doubt. And I can remember on the morning of a very major cycling event, you know, one of the London to Surrey cycling events, which is an international competition. It was done for the Olympics, but in fact, it runs every year. And there was a burst water main in Merton High Street, which threatened to wreck the whole thing. And at 6 o'clock on the Sunday morning, I rang up the chief executive of Thames Water, woke him up, and asked him what he was going to do about it. But you can only do that if you form the relationship on a collaborative. Yes. You can't do that cold. You can only do that because there is a relationship. Both sides want the same thing. And he didn't want them to be responsible for the loss of a major cycling international tournament. And neither did I want to lose the event. So the collaboration was fabulous. And you know, I'm name-checking Thames Water here. They moved from a position of being a bit of a nuisance on the highways network because things were always bursting and causing disruptions. And we got to a quite different position with them where they were collaboratively working with us at TfL to do planned maintenance. We were as liberal as we could with the planned maintenance because we knew if we didn't give them the permits for the planned maintenance, the thing would burst anyway and we'd be in much more trouble. A boss of mine once said, if I'm going to expect you to pull a rabbit out of the hat, you'd better have gone and bought a rabbit at some point in the... Nothing's entirely right.
But you know, I think just on that point about the relationships, and this is where I feel, you know, the last 6-9 months have taught us one thing is, yes, my God, we can work at home. We can do things very differently. But you also need to find ways to build those relationships. I don't know if you listened to any of the CBI conference last week. There was one particular paper I listened to and read in some detail, which was around office spaces. And they called it No Turning Back. And look at those stats about what people think they're going to be doing in the future. And I think where we see offices going is around those collaboration spaces, meeting clients, How do we make sure we don't lose sight of these important connections we make with each other at the expense of obviously just using the technology?
It jars with me in two areas. One is you can't be very creative on Zoom, because by definition, it has a start time and a finish time, and it's in two dimensions. The other thing that worries me about the loss of office-type activity is, again, how do the young people learn? It's very difficult to learn in the sterile surroundings of Zoom. They learn because they see senior managers' behaviours. They learn because they're in meetings. There are chats in the canteen. There are creative chats in the breakout areas. There are the chance meetings by the coffee machine. And that's how young people learn. And I'm especially worried that certainly for this year, and what's more for subsequent years, if office working is much diminished, that it'd be very hard for the young people to be inspired, to learn and to develop themselves. And we'll sort of pick up a bit of a generation gap of people without enough skills to be the senior managers going forward.
Oh, spot on. I remember when I got relatively senior, and I was feeling a bit proud of myself. And then my MD at the time said, don't forget you had the opportunity to be exposed, to have exposure. That's what made the difference. And, you know, I've thought of that long and hard. You're so right. You learn behaviours. Now, obviously, there's a danger we create mini-me's, and that's why we want that diversity very much into it. But that opportunity to learn, to look at people like yourself, so Peter Hendy and others, who've, you know, leaders of the sector, to recognise that's how one behaves, that's what you're meant to do, the understanding, the behaviours. Losing that, I think, Leon, as you've just said, could create a gap which will take years to recover.
Oh, I agree. So, James, what do you think the future holds for the whole road network?
Well, I've really enjoyed listening to your podcast where you've had, you know, your friends talking around whether it be hydrogen vehicles or it be electric vehicles. Undoubtedly, we'll have a mixed economy for lots of reasons, as you've heard people talk about. For me, as somebody who manages and maintains a road network, what I'm looking forward to is what we call the naked highway. The day where the signs have gone, the traffic lights, that we don't need to maintain all these assets which put our people at risk. And actually, whatever technology it is, we're actually utilising it to effectively remove everything from the road and have that naked highway. And that's what I'm looking forward to, and trying to, everything we do as a business and where we spend our money in innovation is about how do we just keep removing the assets, removing the people. That's success. Success is a day I don't have someday on that road.
James, what a wonderful place to end. The optimistic, positive view of the future, what you call the naked highway, which will have no assets that need erecting, maintaining and removing, that won't pose a danger to other people and won't need operatives to go and put themselves at any risk. So it's been really interesting to have our half an hour lunch, James. I'm sorry it's not a proper lunch, but we can repair that when we're allowed to. So this has been Lunch with Leon. It's an itthub.net production. Please go across to our website where you'll see a fabulous news channel, information about this and other podcasts. And I've had for lunch today my guest, James Hallock, who's the Managing Director Highways for AAMI. James, really enjoyed it. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Many thanks, Leon. Great to chat.